Today is April the 18th, 2018. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of this program is available on wbai.org/archive, on prn.fm, and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio in New York and PRN.FM on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are, well, a little different. The definition of Catch-22 is a dilemma or difficult circumstance from which there is no escape because of mutually conflicting or dependent conditions. Democrat House Representative Ben Lujan from New Mexico at the recent hearing on Facebook posed a question to Mark Zuckerberg of how the collection of data by Facebook of non-Facebook subscribers be deleted. The response was definitely a catch-22.
Facebook has detailed profiles on people who have never signed up for Facebook, yes or no?
Congressman, in general, we collect data of people who have not signed up for Facebook for security purposes to prevent the kind of scraping that you were just referring to.
So these are called shadow profiles? Is that what they've been referred to by some?
Congressman, I'm not familiar with that.
I'll refer to them as shadow profiles for today's hearing. On average, how many data points does Facebook have on each Facebook user?
I do not know off the top of my head.
So the average for non-Facebook platforms is 1,500. It's been reported that Facebook has as many as 29,000 data points for an average Facebook user. Do you know how many points of data that Facebook has on the average non-Facebook user?
Congressman, I do not off the top of my head, but I can have our team get back to you afterwards.
I appreciate that. It's been admitted by Facebook that you do collect data points on non-average users. So my question is, can someone who does not have a Facebook account opt out of Facebook's involuntary data collection?
Congressman, anyone can turn off and opt out of any data collection for ads, whether they use our services or not. But in order to prevent people from scraping public information, which again, the search feature that you brought up only showed public information, people's names and profiles and things that they'd made public, but nonetheless, we don't want people aggregating even public information.
But
we need to know when someone is trying to repeatedly access our services.
If I may, Mr. Zuckerberg, I'm about out of time. It may surprise you that we've not talked about this a lot today. You've said everyone controls their data, but you're collecting data on people that are not even Facebook users, that have never signed a consent, a privacy agreement, and you're collecting their data. And it may surprise you that on Facebook's page, when you go to, I don't have a Facebook account and would like to request all my personal data stored by Facebook, it takes you to a form that says, go to your Facebook page, and then on your account settings, you can download your data. So you're directing people that don't have access, don't even have a Facebook page, to have to sign up for a page to release their data. We've got to fix that.
Hey, Joe, you heard that audio clip. You have any comments on that?
Well, it's worse than a catch-22 because it's absolutely misleading. If I don't have an account there and they have all my data, if I open an account, it's going to be a different account from the previous data that they've saved, and I won't be able to kill it. It's totally misleading.
Well, like we said before, can you trust them? Now, actually, I did a little more work on it. Consumers Report wrote a very detailed article on how they actually get the data. It's interesting because you go to many websites and they would have little things on the as part of the main page. You know, when you bring up a page, they have Facebook, Twitter, mail, email, you know, the whole thing, okay? And so long as that Facebook symbol is on that page, you're on. It doesn't matter whether you like it or not. That information that you were on that page is captured by Facebook. Did you know that?
Yes, I did. And it's one of the many, many reasons why the thought of having any privacy and using the internet are really pretty mutually exclusive.
Well, you know, we've had this hearing about, you know, 2 weeks ago, last week, and I just hope it's not one of those things where it just sort of like, okay, that's past news, nothing gets done. And people will go on like typically they have a short memory for any major news happening, and they just go on with life and not realizing that, guess what? Nothing was changed. You're still being captured.
Well, it's maybe even a little worse than I thought, because ever since we did that show, I've been doing some experimenting and seeing how hard or how easy it would be to accomplish anything. I was very pleased by the fact that I could deactivate my account immediately, and people would not be able to access any of the information until I found out that's not true. I deactivated my account, and it was reactivated by somebody else.
That's right. When they sent you an email with a link that has that Facebook symbol, and you opened it up, and guess what? You're back on.
I'm back on. Now, the other thing is I have deleted the account. We'll see whether I get any contacts as a result of that. But I gave it some thought, and there is a way to maintain your privacy and still use Facebook.
And how's that?
First of all, you'll need either two computers or at least two separate browsers. When on one browser, open up a Facebook account under a pseudonym. Don't put in any information about yourself that's true. Fake the address, fake the phone number, fake whatever you want to fake, but nothing true. That's your Facebook account. You can stay in contact with your relatives. They don't care if it's phony information or not.
Can I tell you, go ahead. Can I tell you what the fallacy of that is? If you're doing it from your home, your IP address is still the same. You haven't changed anything.
I left out the most important step. First, buy a good VPN. Or, if you don't want to pay for one, there's only one out there that I can recommend that is a non-paid for one, and that's Tor, G-O-R, the Onion Router.
Well, you know, Joe, since you mentioned VPN, I don't think we're going to make any headway on this Facebook thing other than to say that for people to be aware that you're being tracked, and if you are a subscriber, you're happy with the service, you don't mind being tracked, fine, continue to use Facebook, but try not to get other people hooked into where their information is invaded. And for those who don't want any part of Facebook, well, you try to make all attempts to avoid it, and if he doesn't make any money, well, maybe he'll change his business model. You know, talking about VPN, Joe, you know, there was a Opera made an announcement, and I don't know if you're aware of it. Opera, as you know, the current version of it, a VPN is available for the desktop as well as the mobile version, and they've announced that they are going to shut down the mobile version of they're not going to shut down the mobile version of Opera, but they're going to shut down the VPN option on it.
Wait a minute. You're saying if I currently use the free VPN that Opera bought and now offers to all of its users free,
mm-hmm.
it's going away?
On the mobile version. The mobile version for iOS and Android will be shut down on April the 30th, which is only a short time away from now. However, those who have Opera Gold members, in other words, they paid for the commercial part of it, they'll have an option of having a free one-year subscription to Surf Easy Ultra VPN, and they're cutting it out. I think I know why, okay, Joe, and I'm only guessing. I have no definitive information on it, but I find that on the desktop version of Opera with VPN, it slows everything down almost like 40-50%. And as you know, on a cell phone where the processors are a lot slower And they may be getting a lot of complaints, and people have been avoiding using it because it is slow. Now,
here's the thing. I have Opera, which is really Surfeasy, on my phone.
Mm-hmm.
And only when I have to connect through a public network do I use it. If I'm sitting someplace and I can access NYC Link, I will first activate the Opera Free VPN. It slows the machine down almost unusably. But if you just have to send an email, you just have to. It's important. Or you have to send, receive an email. All right, so it's slow, but at least you have it, and you have some safety in it.
Well, from what I've been reading, there are two other, VPNs available that are free that will run under Opera. It's called Tunnel Bear and Windscribe. So I think I'm going to give it a try. That's Tunnel, TUNNELBEAR. It's free. And the other one is Windscribe, WINDSCRIBE.
Well, you know, just because somebody has a VPN and is offering a free VPN, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're getting any good security. You want to know how many servers they have, what countries the servers are located in, what kind of data they retain. Do they retain logs of your usage? Some do. What kind of security are they offering? Are they encrypted from point to point, or are they only encrypted part of the way? It's misleading to say you get a VPN. I asked Michael. Michael Horowitz is our webmaster, is fairly familiar with this subject. He used to run a column called Defense of Computing. And he felt that the subject was so deep and so complex that while he'll talk about it sometime, he's not yet prepared to go on the air to talk about it, because he's hesitant at this point to be put in the position of having to recommend something. The only one that I'm willing to recommend at the present time, and my knowledge is extremely limited, let's clear that up right at the beginning, is a thing called Tor. T-O-R stands for the Onion Router. It's a open source. Well, is that really true? Is it really open source, Hank, or is it? It's a charity. It's a nonprofit. But it's very good. It's got many, many, many servers in many, many, many countries. And I don't know if it's.
Well, that's something I have to verify, Joe. I understand that Tor, NSA tracks everyone who uses Tor.
A Tor router?
Yes.
And a Tor.
Right. Now, how much information they get might be very little, but they do identify who is using Tor.
Yeah.
And so the reason why I bring that up is because what little information they have, if you cross-check that with other information the way Facebook does it, you could build a whole profile not realizing that, wow, where did you get all that information from? You got to remember that with the government, they have access to other data that really that you can't get, but they have it. Like, for instance, the IRS information, they have access to that. They also have access to when you vote, the Board of Election, all that information, motor vehicle. So unfortunately, with the medical records we have, I think they have access to those too, because if you go through Medicare or Medicaid and other health services, you can't get away from it.
Well, Medicare doesn't really maintain your medical records. It had some of the information, but not all.
Yeah, but Joe, as you know, I had a major operation, and as soon as I got out of the hospital, I was getting these calls, and I was saying to myself, how did they know I was in the hospital? And I was like, Hey, it had to either come from the doctor or the hospital or someone working with a hospital or the doctor.
Well, I'm not, since I don't know the answer to the question, I'm not going to accuse anybody.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, there's a couple of things I really got to get out there because from a consumer point of view, we have to put out a couple of alerts, okay? One that just came out last night that my son got me to look at was that it turns out that, as you know, about a year ago, Avast bought out Sea Cleaner from Apiro. And it's an excellent product. A lot of people use Sea Cleaner. What the Sea Cleaner does is that originally it was called Crap Cleaner, and now they call it Sea Cleaner because it sounds a lot better. And what Sea Cleaner does is that you have a lot of junk files. What happens is that when the when a program runs, they have work files. They don't bother cleaning it up. They don't close it. In other words, they just leave it out there because look how fast I am. Well, they're fast because they don't clean up these junk files. This is almost like reading a newspaper and, oh, I see an article I like. You cut out the article and you take the newspaper and you just throw it in the corner. Before you know it, you got a lot of things there. And what that does is that it increases the search time as you go along. Sea Cleaner cleans up all that junk and it speeds up the system. And I always tell people, or at least I've been recommending to people, two things you do at least once a week. One is run through a registry cleaner and the other one is run through a file cleaner like Sea Cleaner. And I know with a lot of people who have since done that, they haven't called me in a long while. So it's working. Now, what happened was that the hackers got into the corporate labs of Avast and they infected the Sea Cleaner. But they did not. Now, this is a surprising part, Joe. They did not harm any consumers. They identified 11 corporations and they went after 11 corporations. However, if you don't feel comfortable at all, what you should do is just download the latest one. They've since cleaned it up, and you'll feel probably more confident of the program. It's a great program, though. You have any comments on that, Joe?
The only thing, Frank, is that they did do this, but they themselves focused on a few major sites. They gave the Sea Cleaner itself the ability to implant itself elsewhere. And mm-hmm. The danger always is that they're going to activate that feature. So I would make sure that you got it out of your system and that you cleaned up your entire system to make sure you got rid of their footprints with Sea Cleaner.
Well, when you say clean up the whole system, one of the things I normally recommend is that when you uninstall a program, there are three stages. One is that it just removes the executable program. To me, that's not doing the job, okay? The other is it cleans up the directory or subdirectory that the program was installed in. It's normally on the programs or programs x86 subdirectory. Manually clean that out because what they do is they leave these mouse trail in there so that it resurrects itself on boot ups and, in other words, they come alive. The third thing to do is to make sure that the registry is also cleaned up. And if you could do that, then you're pretty sure that all that stuff is gone. I don't know, Joe, if you've noticed that if you were to uninstall a copy of Chrome and you put the latest Chrome in, which is 66, by the way, it's a crazy number, but they're up to version 66, and somehow remembers all the stuff that you left in there, such as the bookmarks and so on, it's because you got these mouse trails. So when you uninstall, make sure you clean it out. Three areas. Uninstall the program, clean out the subdirectory, and clean up the registry before you reinstall the program. Joe, there's another area that people that should be aware of because you brought to my attention. Android phones sell about a 2-to-1 compared to iPhones, and there's a lot of different Android phones out there. And you brought to my attention that some of these new phones are missing security patches, although they claim to have it. Let me just say that when you buy a phone, let's say an Android phone, there are a couple of things you can do. There is a setting. What you do is you go to settings and you go to About Phone. And from About Phone, you go to Android Version. And from Android Version, you go to Android Security Patch Level. and there you see a date. And if the date is after the date of purchase, then at least you know that you do have some security patches in there. The latest patch right now is January 2018. And if you don't have January 2018 for the latest patches of Android, you can make the changes there. So be alert that some of these phones. Now, the reason why it happens is that it's not necessarily the manufacturer, but, you know, you have an inventory of equipment out there. And if it sits there for a while or when it's sold, it's right off the shelf and whatever is sitting in there. So if the person who sold it to you did not get it upgraded or updated for you, and I can understand that because he has to open up the package. If he opens up the package, you say, I want a new phone. And then you're going to say, well, no, wait, that's open. Well, so remember now, if you have an Android phone, and even if you had your Android phone for a while, go to Settings, About Phone, Android Version, and the Android Security Patch Level. Latest one is January 2018. The other thing that I want to forewarn people about, because all these are really consumer alerts, is that Apple is warning that all Mac OS users to start moving away from 32-bit apps because they're going to stop supporting it. So you want to make sure that whatever applications you have which are in 32-bit format, you have to upgrade it. And if you're not running with the latest operating system, well, you got to do it. If you don't do it, you're not going to be able to run the 64-bit version. So that's another consumer alert. And by the way, since we're talking about Apple, Joe and I were commenting to each other that Apple had announced something that kind of surprised me. And what surprised me was that last week they caught 29 employee leakers, and 12 of them were arrested last year, and they went to jail. You know, in the old days, when you commit a white-collar crime, you get a slap on the wrist, you get fired. Well, this is serious stuff. Apple is now sending a message to all the employees they have. Look, we have assets there, and we don't want you to release code. We don't want you to talk about it. If you do, at the minimum, you're going to get fired. At the worst is, we're going to get you prosecuted and sent to jail. So that's something that I applaud them for doing it, because one of the things that people always talk about is white-collar crime pays because no one ever goes to jail. Well, it's about time someone did it. And the other thing that I want to comment on is that there is it's happening because I'm starting to see it. Gmail has a new design. And when they talk about a new Gmail design, they're talking about the desktop version. In the desktop version, mobile version, they don't look quite the same. I know that when I'm looking at Gmail on my cell phone, the navigation is different from the navigation on the desktop. Well, the desktop version will be moving more towards what the cell phone one looks like. So, by the way, we had lost connection with Joe and we were unable to be in touch with him, so that's why you haven't heard his voice, and we apologize for that, but he's okay. He's fine, and he's been under the weather for quite a while, and now he's recovering from it. And, well, we just hope that next week, not only do we have the communication lines back alive, everything is fine. So now we're going to get to the feature segments. Let's get to it right now. Tonight, for our feature segments, we have from the Tech Corner, what to do with Amazon packages you didn't order. I will also be talking about the Supreme Court taking up the Internet sales tax case. On the home automation front with Marty Winston, I asked him for a report from the NAB convention held last week in which he attended in Las Vegas. You go answer your doorbell, and you open your door, and there sitting on your welcome mat is a clearly marked package from Amazon. Thing is, you didn't order anything from them, and upon a close inspection, it's apparent that this delivery isn't for you. What should you do? Simple delivery mistakes happen all the time.
If it's a simple case of a wrong address, correct address, and you know whom the package is intended for, like for a neighbor, well, you can walk it over to their place. If it's small enough, place it in their mailbox. If not, give a knock on their door and hand it off. Otherwise, just set it down in front of their door with a shipping label facing up so it's clearly visible. If you don't know the recipient, well, Amazon gave you a present. According to the Federal Trade Commission, any merchandise mailed to you that you did not order may be legally kept as a free gift. That goes for Amazon or any other retailer who ships goods and include any incorrect items mailed to your address, even if the package is correctly addressed to you. More likely than not, Amazon will tell you to keep the item if you reach out to customer service. Well, here's hoping it's something good. Okay, but say the item isn't something you want, or it bothers your conscience and it won't let you keep it. In that case, you can contact Amazon and offer the return of merchandise. Just make sure that Amazon is the one who pays for all aspects of the return shipping. It's illegal for them not to. That means you give a reasonable amount of time, let's say 30 days, for them to pick up the item and have it returned, and you shouldn't have to pay a cent for any of it. If they don't pick it up in time, well, you can keep it or toss it out. If this happened to you multiple times and the name on all of the packages is the same, it may be a case of a previous tenant using their old default Amazon shipping address. Feel free to reach out to your local U.S. Postal Inspector to let them know that the person doesn't live there anymore. There's not much else you can do. The United States Supreme Court heard the South Dakota appeal on the internet sales tax law this Tuesday. A total of 35 other states have weighed in on South Dakota's side. The justices will decide whether to overturn 50 years worth of ruling that forbid states from imposing sales taxes on whatever their residents buy from out-of-state retailers. Ending the ban would bring billions of dollars in new revenues to the states. In 1967, the Supreme Court ruled that states could not force mail-order catalog companies to collect sales taxes unless a buyer lived in a state where the company had a physical presence, a retail store, a headquarters, or a distribution center, for example. The court reasoned that the volume of mail-order business was minor compared to in-store sales and that catalog companies would face too big a burden in having to figure out the correct sales tax, given widely different rates around the company. But South Dakota concluded in 2016 that the explosion in online sales changed the market drastically, so it passed a law requiring all but the smallest retailers, including internet companies, to collect taxes on the sales they make in the state, even if they had no physical presence there. Lower courts, however, blocked the law, relying on the Supreme Court precedents, and the justices hear the state's appeal on Tuesday. A total of 35 other states have weighed in on South Dakota's side. The internet now makes it possible for out-of-state sellers to reach consumers with engaging, interactive virtual storefronts in our homes or on our smartphones at any hour of the day. As for the burden of dealing with thousands of tax rates across the country, the state says software programs now make it possible for a retailer to instantly compute the correct sales tax simply by entering a buyer's zip code. The number of local tax jurisdictions has doubled to 12,000, and local laws vary widely on what goods are subject to sales taxes. During back-to-school tax holidays, for example, some states exempt clothing, but others don't. Some include shoes, and the definition of what qualifies as school supplies varies widely. Forcing internet retailers to pay sales taxes everywhere would make it much harder for startups to get into the market. While e-commerce is growing rapidly, it still accounts for only about 9% of all retail sales, a smaller share than catalog companies had when the Supreme Court exempted them from paying sales taxes in states where they had no physical presence. The companies also noted that the large internet retailer, Amazon.com, now pays sales taxes in all the states that collect them. That leaves out only Alaska, Delaware, Montana, New Hampshire, and Oregon.
Some local communities have sales taxes in Alaska and Montana, but they are not levied statewide. South Dakota estimates that the states could pick up a combined $34 billion a year if the court allows them to tax internet sales. But the General Accounting Office estimates that the number would be at most about $13 billion. Some states have a use tax. Despite what you sometimes hear, however, some internet sales are subject to sales taxes, and even when a site doesn't collect sales tax, consumers are technically responsible for remitting any unpaid sales taxes on online purchase directly to their state. If an online retailer has a physical presence in a particular state, such as a store, business, office, or warehouse, it must collect sales tax from customers in that state. If a business does not have a physical presence in a state, it is not required to collect sales tax for sales into that state. This rule is derived from a 1992 Supreme Court decision which held that mail order merchants did not need to collect sales taxes for sales into states where they did not have a physical presence. Consumers who live in a state that collects sales taxes are technically required to pay the taxes to the state even when an internet retailer doesn't collect it. When consumers are required to pay taxes directly to the state, it's referred to a use tax rather than sales tax. The only difference between a sales and a use tax is which person, the seller or the buyer, pays the state. Theoretically, use taxes are just a backup plan to make sure that the state collects revenue on every taxable item that is purchased within its border. But because collecting use tax on smaller purchases is so much trouble, states have traditionally attempted to collect a use tax only on big-ticket items that require licenses, such as cars and boats. New York State has added a line to income tax returns, requiring all residents to calculate how much they pay on internet, mail order, and out-of-state purchases. California has begun a campaign to educate taxpayers on what's owed. Watch for more states to step up use tax collections. Well, the Supreme Court heard the case, and where did the justice stand? Having arguments in Washington Tuesday in a South Dakota case, the justices considered overturning their 1992 ruling that made much of the internet a tax-free zone by exempting retailers that don't have a physical presence in a state. The high court fight centers on South Dakota law enacted with the implicit aim of overturning Quill. The state is suing Wayfair, Inc., Overstock.com, Inc., and Newegg.Inc., which don't collect taxes in South Dakota. The law would exempt small businesses, but several justices said that if the court opened the door, other states might tax all sales or even make the taxes retroactive. Retailers fighting the state say they would be hit with heavy costs of complying with rules for thousands of products in thousands of cities. U.S. Supreme Court justices signaled that they are divided about whether to let states start collecting billions of dollars in sales taxes from internet retailers that don't currently charge tax to their customers. States and traditional retailers say that the ruling, which involved a mail-order company, is obsolete in the e-commerce era. Broader taxing power would let state and local governments collect an extra $8 billion to $23 billion a year, according to various estimates. Three of the justices, Anthony Kennedy, Neil Gorsuch, and Clarence Thomas, have already indicated they would overturn the 1992 ruling known as Quill versus North Dakota. Ginsburg may join the conservatives to let state start collecting taxes. In Tuesday's hour-long argument, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg suggested that she would join them, twice referring to the Quill precedent as obsolete. She said letting states tax internet sales would mean equalizing sellers. Everybody's treated the same tax collection obligation, Ginsburg said. However, Chief Justice John Roberts said Amazon's tax collection effort might be a reason not to disturb the Quill rule. Justice Sonia Sotomayor indicated she would rather leave it to Congress to overturn the Quill ruling. Sotomayor said the real problem for states was not Quill, but the absence of a mechanism for collecting the taxes directly from the consumers. Justice Elena Kagan suggested that Congress's inaction since the Quill ruling might be a reason to leave it intact. Well, what about the other two justices? Justice Samuel Alito said other states, if allowed, would be more aggressive. He raised a prospect that some would try to impose retroactive liability on retailers. South Dakota's tax laws applies only prospectively. Well, I think he's leaning towards leave it the way it is. And finally, Justice Stephen Breyer contrasted that argument with the contention of South Dakota and its allies that new software would make it easy for retailers to comply, which indicates it might be a 5-4 decision where we gotta pay taxes on everything on the internet. The NAB show was held in Las Vegas last week. It is the world's largest convention encompassing the convergence of media, entertainment, and technology. With 103,000 attendees from 161 countries and 1,800 exhibitors. I asked Marty Winston, since he was going there, to give me a report on it.
I made the trip to Las Vegas last week to attend the NAB show. That's the National Association of Broadcasters. Now, most of this has nothing to do with our cybernetic house project. Well, maybe a few things. I'll save those for later. Right now, I want to start with a view of today's commercial TV industry and its somewhat recent history. Now, the station and network economy has actually improved since past years, although good would be a misleading conclusion. In even years, they see late-year windfall revenues from election advertising. In the past, ownership groups diverted those extra revenues into their newspaper properties to make those look like they had shallower than actual losses. With those newspapers now downsized and many having shut down, the balance sheets look a little better, but election windfalls are not, by and large, funding station or network operations. In odd years, broadcast revenues are way down, with a lot of belt tightening and agony. With the shrinkage of youth viewing and the increasing productivity of competing ad venues like Google and Facebook, the fat old days aren't likely to ever return. And that's why one continuing undercurrent at the NAB show across so many of the products was about making TV operations work with fewer and lower cost staffers. And in jest, I'll define some of these terms in a minute, and workflows, playout, ENG, which is electronic news gathering, studio cameras, closed captioning, and more, all moved or are trying to move from operating expenses to capital expenses by using fewer people and more automation, or in some cases to low-cost cloud services, software as a service, SaaS. Most in-house operations with any ability beyond news to produce in-house content got gutted during all of the phasing out of cost centers, and that helped create a content aftermarket. In several rounds over the years, well, the stations would offer senior people a chance to take the buyout, get a lump sum, so they could reduce staff cost. It was kind of like a discount early retirement. And it put a lot of very talented content creators out into the streets. Now, there were always secondary markets. You know, wedding videos were a popular early target. The emergence of YouTube as a potential revenue stream, the sale of services to companies wanting videos for various purposes, many driven by a desire for online video, and similar aftermarket venues began a growth in both entrepreneurial and avocational content creation, all the way to independent films and series for streaming networks that weren't there before. Improvements in smartphone video became a launchpad for broadly giving that a try. Improvements in Mac platform performance, price drops in higher resolution video gear, and a lot of product size bandwagon jumping also helped the frenzy grow into a whirlpool. But the rainbow got a lot bigger with the arrival of new layers of those stream-based entertainment networks, operated and funded by big players, which, of course, encouraged smaller players to also give it a shot. And that engendered the bubble we ride today, and it's time to look at that from the TV station product side. We'll start with products for shooting. The amateur may have one camera and exist on a small supply of SD cards as the recording medium and maybe one external drive, but at any level above that, data storage today echoes the priorities of the film reels of old. Identification, organization, safe retention. Well, flash memory biscuits, from SD cards to cartridges, are today's ubiquitous capture media. The transfer of those capture media to transport media, transfer from capture to transport, which is often external hard drives, well, that may exist in several layers before the captured content is actually ingested into an integrated workflow system at the station or the network or the production house. Fast portable drives, of course, are a wonderful asset to these stages because the faster the drive, the sooner that bit of work is over with, and the quicker you can get back to getting something more productive done. Now, I mentioned ingest. It means ways to bring video or audio into an overall system for assembling and editing and otherwise working on the content. The overall system for doing that involves mostly software running on anything between a Mac and a high-end graphic workstation. I mean, even more capable and more expensive than those high-performance systems that gamers love. Now, that system, that multi-user, often multi-user system, is called workflow. And it can be accomplished by one person, or it may be passed from specialist to specialist on a networked system. The assumption that most content workflow is Mac-centric, well, it's largely still true, but it's not always true. My discussions with a post-production head at HSN QVC tells me that their workflow is heavily and deeply Mac-based. At ABC News, that's no longer the case, and their workflows are almost all Linux-based. In every case, from minuscule to mammoth, regardless the operating system or software environment, the trends involve more, faster, safer storage, and cost is hardly ever a factor. SAN and NAS solutions. SAN is storage area network. NAS is network attached storage. Don't worry about the differences. SAN and NAS solutions are migrating through 40 gig Ethernet and fiber networks. Some are still hitting bandwidth limits. Backups, beyond those intrinsic to RAID and other drive arrays, have become asynchronous, meaning they don't happen at the same time as the initial write. They are delegated to slower hours because of the bandwidth limits in some cases, because of challenges in rack implementation of blades, tiny computers that work in conjunction with larger tasks, and in some cases, awaiting implementation of secondary and tertiary networks. I'll talk about the IT side in a few minutes. When the content is produced and polished, the next step is playout. Content playout has merged into the tail end of workflows, and beyond specific hardware or SaaS, software as a service implementations, it's really not a very separate entity. Now, that said, it is not often a simple consideration. The same content may have to play out in standard def, in HD, in 4K, in various stream formats, and so on. That used to take people sitting there and going through a checklist, rendering in one format and then the next and then the next. Well, up-to-date gear maintains its own checklist of desired playout modes, and all those formats and targets and everything are now automated. NAB had things to learn beyond broadcasting, at least things for me to learn. I had opportunities for informative conversations with some key players in storage media, Seagate, Western Digital, and others, and they largely confirmed things I observed and believed. Rotating media, spinning magnetic platter hard drives, retain strong cost per capacity benefits at the expense of speed, but are fully viable in appropriate applications and where either cost or capacity outweighs speed in a purchaser's priorities. NVR, network video recorders, and surveillance applications are at that rapid growth leading edge of a boom market, and it's universally regarded as an opportunity not to be missed. Restorable backups remain an under-addressed or unaddressed category across the board, from individuals to enterprises. The storage guys think it's ignorance on the part of individuals and too much trust in arrays by the enterprises. Both surveillance and backups are write mostly applications best suited to write optimized drives, but the product managers feel that there's just not a lot of understanding of write optimized versus read optimized and which goes where when. Pay attention when you're putting together your own hardware. Endpoint and near endpoint playout facilities, meaning things like media servers, but evolved. Those are read mostly applications. Many may involve server farms, but others that are nearer the endpoint, like in schools or hotels or training facilities, corporate asset centers, and so on, those often operate in simpler rack arrays. Rack arrays, it's IT time. Let's talk array storage. I got to every booth I could find offering rack mount arrays and let them all pitch me. That's the magic of a press badge. I think this will go more quickly if I distill my observations and deductions into bullet points. 40 gigabit Ethernet is the new focal point for network attached storage, at least in enterprises and a lot of broadcasters. IT sites that are still on 10 gigabit or not yet on 10 gigabit seem almost embarrassed by that. Sites with SAN or NAS storage never seem to consider that network-attached backup usurps bandwidth. Those who do are more likely to think in terms of adding networks than in terms of direct attach. Direct attach storage has become my choice for things in the cybernetic house control rack. It's bandwidth invisible for networks. The recovery of broken arrays is a claim that I think every one of the software-based array products made, but my impression, it feels like they're all about a year short of being really ready for prime time. Hardware RAID solution sellers focus on solid-state memory support, SSD support, as their darling feature, again, with higher cost per capacity than spinning hard drives, trading off for speed. Where DAS, direct-attach storage, is available, Thunderbolt 3 seems to be the common pipe. Now, Thunderbolt 3 deserves your attention. It can pipe a lot of services and a lot of protocols all at once. Its overall bandwidth, this is one little cable, its overall bandwidth is 40 gigabits per second. It can network computers at 10 gigabits per second and a lot more. My cybernetic house has 6 intranets, all of them at 1 gig. So here's a capsule of how the things I learned at NAB fit into my realm. The house has a network video recorder in the rack, essentially a Windows 10 system running Blue Iris software and connecting to 32 HD cameras, all external, all 1080p, all with power over Ethernet connected through PoE surge suppressors, all on one 1 gigabit network. The NVR is configured with a RAID 6 array of write-optimized hard drives that record when triggered to do so. RAID 6 means you could lose two drives, and the array remains intact and operating. I'm going to add an ASUS Thunderbolt 3 PCIe adapter to that NVR box so it can direct attach to a second RAID 6 array in its own rack mount case, also with write-optimized hard drives. And that second array will be the first array's backup, the backup to the NVR, the surveillance system's network video recorder. Now, the MySQL Server is not a good fit for file-based backup. Instead, it uses a technique called replication to keep its data safe. And obviously, I'm going to make as sure as I can that losses can't happen there. Hank often asks me about backing up the network of Raspberry Pi boards. Think of 100 boards, each with a 32-gig micro SD card. Now, most of those cards carry less than 4 gig, and we never write to those cards. We only write to the MySQL database. We can carry images or file and folder sets for each and every card in less than half a terabyte of memory in the MySQL server. Very much less, considering the extent to which things like libraries and audio files are broadly duplicated among the nodes. We could also dedicate a thin client to the job of burning any requested micro SD card on request, either based on its own modest drive or on fetching the data sets from the MySQL server. Since this is a very occasional application, a two-drive thin client, if necessary, one drive can be external, can provide its own backup. We're looking at thin clients anyway as an alternative for more robust processing tasks like image recognition. So those NAB inspirations can help my cybernetic house gain reduced network congestion and another few levels of good old backup, backup, backup. Hank?
Thank you, Marty.
Public service announcements of scheduled computer club meetings in the tri-state northeastern region. The Princeton PCs user group will be meeting Tuesday, April the 24th at 7 p.m., Mercer County Library, Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on VPN, the importance of having one, Thursday, April the 26th. The meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they'll meet at the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society will have their meeting on Tuesday, May 1st. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The Westchester PC Users Group will have their general meeting May 3rd, Thursday. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and it will be held at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor at White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their main meeting on May 4th, Friday. Meeting time is 8 p.m., Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club has its general meeting on Thursday, May 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. The meeting will be at NYU, Silver Building, room 405, located in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will have its meeting on Friday, May 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. S. Schur Hall. By the way, if you never attended a computer meeting, you should attend. If you have any questions, this is a place you can go to where you can ask people about their experience and if they have any comments about products or problems that you may have. And all these meetings, they have a random access session that you will probably be able to ask your question, and there is no such thing as a dumb or stupid question in computing. All these computer club meetings are free and open to the public. We hope to see you at the meetings. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio or www.wbai.org streaming on the internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key. On behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.